emerging theories of health behavior. DiClemente is the first author. Ralph DiClemente.
And as Scott had mentioned in the beginning, as the chapters become available, they will be posted on our website as white papers.
And my that chapter, because you probably don't want to buy a textbook to get it, is available on a public website of mine, oregonstate.edu/tildflayb. oregonstate.edu/tildflayb.
And if you have questions, you can always email us and we can put you in contact as well. So now for those of you who came in late, Scott is actually going to fill in and play the role of Tom Tyler, and he will talk to us about mechanisms of legal effect from the procedural justice perspective.
I initially got into research, empirical research on law, as a law professor trying to understand better how does the legal system work? You know, what is this law thing? What is it doing? And, you know, so when you look across the story we're telling here, you know, Brian has just told a story of how if you think of law at not as different or distinct, but as being about being a driver of behavior among many, then fitting law within a broader explanation of behavior is really useful, because then you're not assuming law is the primary mechanism. You're not kind of excluding all sorts of stuff that might be really important. You're fitting law into the complexity of behavior. Well, one of the advantages of starting with a theory that's about the legal system or about how law works is that it will perhaps more directly give you information about how to make law work better. So you get, in addition to trying to understand why people comply with the law, a system that tends to focus on what the legal system does to influence behavior also then identifies levers for improving compliance or improving behavior. And that's an example of that is the work on procedural justice and compliance that Tom Tyler has been doing for almost 20 years. Tyler, who also has nothing to disclose, including his appearance, is actually, you know, he sort of embodies, I would say, the trajectory we kind of love to see. He started as he remains a social psychologist. He has not repudiated his roots. But he's just this year moved from NYU, where he was a very highly regarded, esteemed, and I'm sure courted and overpaid professor of psychology, to Yale Law School, where he's an astronomically overpaid and even more courted and feted professor of law. He's a brilliant man, and this work is brilliant. I present it only as an admirer. But among the other reasons I admire it is that he has demonstrated that you can take really good social science and make it really important to law, so important to law that you know, you're sucked into the vortex of legal academia.
I was sucked into public health.
Where you're also very well needed, but probably not as highly paid as you would be at the Yale Law School.
Right.
So what Tom did essentially is to come into a world in which the primary explanation active in the field for why people obey the law was deterrence theory. Which was very consistent with economic theories that have been dominant for a long time, because it's essentially about rational people calculating their utilities and acting accordingly. And Tom, as a psychologist, didn't think a lot about rational people calculating utilities right off the bat as a primary explanation for behavior. But also, you know, as someone who is well trained in social theory, thought a lot, you know, thought back to some older explanations of legal compliance, and particularly to Max Weber's notion of legitimacy, the idea that people will obey the law out of a sense of respect for and obligation to the social institutions that produce the law. And sort of thinking about law in those terms, he began to be interested less in what you might call the rare case of someone who is punished, the rare case of someone who apparently is acting out of fear of punishment, and probably the even rarer case of someone who is punished, to ask, well, isn't most compliance actually self-motivated? I mean, we don't really go around and have a policeman on everybody's shoulder. Most of the time, people are just obeying the law for some other reason. You know, whether they're at 2 in the morning at the stoplight and there's no stoplight camera and there's no other car in sight, there's no policeman, but they still sit there. Or, you know, you go to Germany and they stand at the light, wait for the walk signal, even though there are no cars coming. You know, they're not going to get into any trouble. Why are they obeying the law? Why do we pay our taxes when the chances of being audited and caught are really, really, really low? Is deterrence really the right explanation? And what we'll talk about is what he came up with instead. But I also want to talk about then some of the broader questions his work has continued to raise. I mean, for one thing, he started out trying to explain individual compliance in public health, and in fact in regulation generally, we're much more interested in organizational compliance. And we don't necessarily want to think about whether whether U.S. Steel is complying with environmental regulations is the question, not whether, you know, Joe Steelworker in Pittsburgh is doing the specific thing they're supposed to do. And that leads to a lot of unanswered questions that are still being developed in this theory. But there are also implications of this theory for public health practice and policy that I want to point to, because, again, it's a useful example of how theory and theory used in research also ends up having a lot of insights for people who are immediately doing practice and won't want to wait for the ultimate product of the research. Because after all, theory in empirical science is really about a way about thinking about the world. And thinking about the world rigorously is useful even if you're not immediately analyzing data or collecting data. So one of the questions that I think is quite interesting related to is the question of whether his theories of procedural justice and how they affect people's attitudes towards compliance are also relevant to our really challenging efforts to think about how you take social determinants theories and turn it into practices and policies that actually may affect and change some of the upstream factors that are so powerfully shaping levels and distributions of health. It's also interesting to think about procedural justice, and I will a little bit in this talk, in terms of its implications for, the staple work that health people do in public education, public information, in, everything from warning labels to food pyramids. Does procedural justice have anything to say about why people comply with those kinds of recommendations? So let's posit a new law. You've all seen this picture, hopefully not just in the rearview mirror, but as you've dodged a big SUV that didn't seem to see you turning a corner. We have a lot of states now making it a law to text and to use the phone hands-free. But imagine a state that makes it an offense to operate a motor vehicle using any mobile communication device at all in any way, which is what the research would suggest is necessary to prevent accidents, and that it provides for secondary enforcement, which means that the violator can only be ticketed if they're stopped for another offense, which in positing a driver who is well up on literature means that they're very likely not to be very effective because secondary enforcement doesn't do much. So you're not going to really be deterring people much with a secondary enforcement cell phone law. Now, the key thing here is that, I'm positing this, but I bet you'd find it in polling, that people are not convinced that using a cell phone in any way, even hands-free, is actually dangerous. So they don't, sort of agree, oh, well, that's a smart law. So will they obey this law just because it's the law? That's the question of legitimacy. Legitimacy is as Weber conceptualized it, a quality possessed by an authority or a law or an institution that leads others to feel obligated to accept its directives. We do it because they're a legitimate giver of rules. And the upshot is that when people feel that way, they become willing subjects whose behavior is strongly influenced by the rules. So you kind of have a picture that looks like this. You have a law. If that law or the lawgiver is perceived to have legitimacy, then you're going to get compliance. Legitimacy itself has sort of two components to happen. One is this, or two elements that are important that are variables within this, I suppose you could say, the sense of obligation to obey authorities generally, and their sense of trust and confidence in legal authorities. Both have to be maintained, and both can be undermined in different ways, but I'm not going to get into that. The really great thing about this form of normative compliance is that it's efficient and cheap for the ruler, for the regulator. You don't actually have to spend much or anything on surveillance, detection, punishment that you need to make deterrence work. Right? I mean, real law works best and most often when there is no enforcement. And this is what you get when you have a strong sense of legitimacy. What happens is that behavior comes really from self-motivation. Or compliance comes from the individual's own motivation. Now, you know, the story we posited here, I think, hits the critical moment for self-motivated compliance, and really for a lot of what we do in public health in terms of the advice and suggestions and nudges and even the occasional command that we give people. When you forbid something that is not harmful to others, you know, smoking without that damn secondhand smoke, and is not seen as inherently wrongful. You know, the only reason I'm going to obey that is I feel, well, I guess I should. You know, that's what the rule is, I'm going to obey it. So Tyler's work, you know, that's sort of the bedrock of Weber. Tyler's work was to, and his insight was to ask, well, what predicts or produces in practical terms that sense of legitimacy? He didn't want to just say, let's all be Germans, you know, from, you know, 1910 or 1920 or 1930. He wanted to say, you know, let me identify some experiences, some social factors, some events, some things that legal systems do that might increase or decrease the sense of legitimacy. And what he investigated and eventually demonstrated was that procedural justice was a strong predictor of legitimacy, experience of procedural justice. So in other words, when authorities behave fairly, when they follow our traditional norms of procedural justice, impartiality of the decision maker, transparency of the decision making process, respect for human dignity of people in the process, that increases people's sense of legitimacy of the system and therefore their willingness to comply with laws. The complexity that's still being worked out in this literature is exactly who it is that you derive this experience with or from. So, you know, there's a lot of people out there representing our big government. And so if you're thinking about the legitimacy of a health mandate, it's probably not correct to say that people are going to sort of reflect upon their experiences with health officials. It may be that their experience with a policeman is the reference experience. And so you get a lot of complexities there when you start to think about how this is going to cross over to health. And as I say, that's sort of the stuff that goes into the future work. But getting back to the sort of core theory, procedural justice, as Tyler's work has defined it, is the study of people's subjective evaluations of the justice of procedures along two dimensions. One is the fairness of the decision-making process, which is broken into the idea of voice, that you get to say your story, that you get to tell your side of the story, and neutrality of the decision-maker. So so that you have an unbiased, someone listens to that story without bias. And then the fairness of interpersonal treatment within that process. So are you believed? Are you treated as a trustworthy individual who might, you know, be wrong or only a part of the story but not a liar? And secondly, are you treated with respect as someone who has value and dignity? Fair decision-making, you can be more specific here, has to do, and this is where I'm sort of putting this out there very specifically, because this is really about how, you know, we do our work to some degree. When we're making rules or giving advice or interacting with people, this is what they are actually looking for. They're perceiving you as an authority, and this is how they're going to evaluate that experience. So are they getting a chance to talk before the decision is made, to give input? Are there sort of clear and understandable rules for how this decision is going to be made that everyone knows? Can the decision maker show and enact, you know, a process in which the information is taken in, looked at, put together in some way, and then produces a decision that does not appear to be made just out of personal prejudice or bias? And can you see the next case, the next instance, and see that the same process has happened to that person, that we have consistency in processing? These are, in fact, all the norms that we like to believe are apparent in the judicial system, and the judicial system aspires to, but it's not just about judges. Right? When you think about all the points in a vast bureaucracy and a vast system of entitlements, rules, questions that play out in any institution, these are the same values. It's not just for people wearing robes. In terms of fair treatment, and there's a little overlap here you can see conceptually, but they are, I think it's worth going through the list because there's enough distinction that once you put it into practice, you see how this plays out. We have to treat people's interests as valid and important, treat them politely and with dignity, consider their input, and show concern for their input. And finally, giving an account. You know, this is the judicial opinion, and the judicial opinion is given great weight in discussions of judicial systems and their validity, but it's really true of any decision-making system. You know, people are going to want an opinion. They're going to want an explanation, and if they get it, it turns out, if they get this treatment, they will often be satisfied with the process, even if they don't like the outcome. In fact, one of the interesting things for lawyers, but I think it's true for really all of us who give decisions to people, is that people who feel fairly treated, people who feel that they've been given procedural justice, can be just as satisfied at the end if they win as if they lose. It's not the outcome that really drives satisfaction, it's the treatment. I think I said that clearly finally after about four tries. Now, of course, when we get back to the research side, these elements can all be measured. Tyler is a scientist, and he and his colleagues have been developing scales and methods for measuring these kinds of quantities for more than a decade. So you can ask it pretty clearly. You know, if you have somebody interacting with the police, this is from one of his early studies, how fair were the procedures used by the police when they stopped you? And, you know, got a Likert scale, and, you know, it plays out very well. It's validated. You can break it down. Now, here's where we're trying to get into this, the complexities of who is the index, who's the indicator that you're judging fairness from. So in one of his studies, he makes a distinction between the informal decision-making process and the formal decision-making process. So the formal decision-making element is the official rules that people get in their company handbook. You know, and if they're looking at that, you can ask them questions about those rules and what they're supposed to do, and people's experience with, you know, and their reaction to the rules. But of course, there's also the process. In this case, we're looking in a company situation, looking from a company manual, employee manual, to what really happens day to day. So we're asking about the informal decision maker because it may be that the index for fairness here, for the fairness judgment, is not the handbook, but the boss, the immediate, and not even maybe the big boss, but the immediate boss. So in this study, they were looking at both dimensions and trying to find where the sense of procedural justice was coming from. And again, you can also take it into looking at the broader question of corporate compliance. And so, although this is probably too small to read, this happens to be a study by John Braithwaite and Tony Mackay from Australia, did a lot of work on nursing homes and compliance with rules. And what they did is look at essentially CEOs and measures with CEOs of how they felt in relation to the regulators who are coming in and doing site visits and so on. So you ultimately end up with a model that looks something like this in very simple terms. All the stuff we're usually concerned about, you know, law influencing behavior, influencing health. We throw in compliance, because if people don't obey the law, then that's not likely to be a factor in their behavior or their health. We throw in motivation, because we realize that the more they're likely to do it on their own, the less resources are required from us in terms of surveillance and punishment. And that taps us into the procedural justice to legitimacy pathway, in which the focus here is, in terms of active terms, is that if you are a regulator, you may get much more bang for your buck by projecting and ensuring perceptions of procedural justice in the way you implement your rules than you will be in standing over somebody's shoulder and hitting them over the head every time they deviate. You'd rather have them motivated to behave on their own, comply on their own, than have to be watched. Now, if you think about how this, that sort of looking at basic evaluation of effects of law sort of research, trying to understand why one system might, one implementation might lead to good results and another might lead to poor results. But thinking ahead, you know, I'm quite interested in thinking of procedural justice research as a great tool for understanding that whole nexus of hierarchy, stress, and unequal, the gradient, the unequal distribution of health outcomes that's so strongly associated with work and classically exemplified by the Whitehall studies. You know, we know that that gradient exists, both within companies and, the British civil service system, but across societies, and we're trying to figure out, all of us in different ways, how can we influence that. And it's interesting that you find a strong correlation between experience of procedural justice and actually measurable stress. Because then it suggests that we can take this notion of procedural justice from regulatory theory, treat it as a social psychological construct, and talk about how we introduce procedural justice into places where you have high stress in order to help reduce that and deal with some of the very negative effects of unjust workplaces on people's lives. So you got to kind of get that pathway. This is very complicated. I don't know if it's quite as... Maybe I think I've outdone Brian here. But this is a... this is an attempt to understand, is a paper that will be forthcoming, I hope, soon, a collaboration of we in public health law research and Glenn Mays and Doug Scutchfield from the public health systems and services research field, trying to understand how we can integrate thinking about law into traditional explanations or into the emerging approaches that PHSSR is developing to understand the determinants of health department functioning. Right? So you might say looking for the law or places where law has some insight in understanding the effectiveness and operation of health authorities. So you can see, you know, we're starting over here, that there's some law that sets a bunch of the parameters, jurisdiction, kinds of authority, regulatory tools available for health agencies. So that's a big input. There's a lot of other elements of structural capacity, including that all too rare element, money. But you know, we're introducing this idea that, well, yeah, you know, legal capacity should matter in understanding how health departments do their work. They are regulatory agencies wielding legal power. Traditionally, that was understood in terms of legal competencies. You know, sort of an objective measure of what people knew about the law and about their role, their legal role within an agency. But you know, we're trying to think more broadly about the legal culture and legal consciousness, how people think about the law and what the organization sort of feels about the law, whether it's an organization with a lot of appetite for using legal authority or an organization that hunkers down whenever the word law is meant. That's what we're actually studying in our research. But from purposes of procedural justice, I mean, there's a couple of really interesting entry points. Of course, down here, obviously, when you were enforcing public health laws and regulations, all this procedural justice stuff, all this stuff about self-motivation, and in fact, a whole related body of regulatory research about essentially assuming the best of people and treating them in a certain sense more positively and fairly until proven otherwise, turns out to have immediate application. You will be a better regulator if you provide procedural justice in your activities, because that will increase self-motivated compliance and save you money. That's very important there, leading to that way. But, you know, it's also really interesting to think about, and I am, say, just beginning to think about this, but I think it's really interesting to think about the implications of legitimacy and procedural justice theories for all the advice we give. You know, we're always telling people, don't eat this, eat that, stop doing that, do more of that. And, you know, when people talk about the government not telling me what to do, when they give the kind of anti-paternalist advice, when they say, well, why should, you know, this week you said this, last week you said that, I mean, there's a lot of ways to understand that reaction. But one way to interrogate that reaction is to ask, well, you know, we feel when the community guide speaks, you know, that's gone through a process that we see as scientifically valid and strong, you know, that we will believe it because it's the community guide. But that perception, as we see just with the recent breast cancer screening and prostate screening recommendations, let alone vaccination stuff, is not universally shared. And so one of the tasks that may be before us is to think about how do we attend to, respond to, and do something about that sense that, you know, who are these people and who do they think they are to tell us what to do? That is actually a pressure point for improving compliance, not just speaking more slowly when we give the recommendation or pointing to the fact that it came from the community guide. Why, you know, why is that process actually transparent and fair? I think it is actually a pretty good process. We need to think about selling it more, for example. So, you know, the bottom line is that we get more compliance with sugar than we do with the stick, or with the carrot than we do with the stick. And we always want to remember that. And we want to try and behave in a way, as much as we can, that is responsive to people's antennae, looking for signs that we listen, that we respect their views, that we explain what we do. Now, you know, certainly no panacea, but it's just a nice insight from the law, as aside from being a really useful tool for studying why people will obey us and why they won't. So, and that's the end of that presentation. Thank you.